this morning's message, a failed conspiracy and triumphant providence. A failed conspiracy and triumphant providence. Acts 23:12-35. You know, as believers in God, in Christ, we know that we are cared for by God. And we know that we ought to surrender to Him. And we trust that God watches over us. You know, there's no step that we take that He doesn't already know, that He has not already ordained. There is no triumph in our life that He doesn't already know and ordain. And likewise, there's no suffering that He doesn't already know and ordain. But often for us, when we look at God's providence and the occurrences in our life, whenever things seem to fall just in place, you know, you're driving out and you're in a hurry, and lo and behold, in the crowded car park, a car backs up just in front of you, and you say, "Wow, that's God's providence. He's in control of all things. He knows what I need at the very right time." And once you get out of your car, you want to go pay for parking. You know, perhaps you're in the city. Then someone comes up to you and say, "By the way, I've got 2 hours left on my ticket that I'm not using. Would you like to have it?" "Oh, of course!" Right? So everything just seems to fall into place. And you say, "God is in charge of everything. How wonderful." You know, it's like the book of Esther. Right? We studied the book of Esther before. Just when the king needed a new wife, Esther entered into the beauty pageant. The moment, you know, two men wanted to plot against the king, that very moment, Mordecai heard of it and he reported it. And the very moment that Haman approached the king to say, "This is my plan to kill Mordecai," the king, you know, he remembered Mordecai and he says, "This man must be rewarded. Ah, Haman, you came in at the right time. How shall we reward Mordecai?" Right? So exactly the moment, and remember, Mordecai had just built this gallows to kill, Haman built these gallows to kill Mordecai. The very moment he went in, right, it was meant for him. We also see in the life of Joseph, which we read, right, he was in Egypt at the right moment so that he could save his entire family. You know, he found himself in prison. The very moment that two influential men were there, they had dreams that only he could interpret. Then the Pharaoh had a dream that only he could interpret. The brothers came, and the person that they met was Joseph. All providence. God directs, and He rules every detail. You know, but at the same time, we must not forget that suffering is also in God's providence. And in each of these cases with Esther and with Joseph, there was great suffering. You know, Joseph was sold into slavery because of the wickedness of his brothers. You know, years he spent in prison. And even when the butler, his dreams were interpreted, forgot him, and Joseph was in prison for 2 whole years. And, you know, the Jews, they also suffered greatly in Esther's time because of Haman's pride. So, you know, sin led to suffering. And that's an important teaching point. You know, we say there's no God because of suffering. Well, suffering is a result of the sinfulness of mankind, right? But we also see that suffering is in God's providence. He rules. Nothing is outside of His will, including our pain. All right? Now, in this passage, we see another account of God's providence. How God took care of Paul, but it was still the will of God that Paul suffered. And Paul would suffer greatly. So there are 3 points in today's message. Firstly, the threat of conspiracy in the name of God. The threat of conspiracy in the name of God. Secondly, the provision of help by a sovereign God. The provision of help. And thirdly, the triumph of God's providence. So firstly, the threat of conspiracy in the name of God. Now, things have not really been going well for Paul. We've been following, you know, his progress. When he was in Ephesus, everything was great. He spent, you know, a year and a half to 2 years there. He was preaching the gospel. Many people came to Christ. And then he began his journey down south, and everything really went south from there. All right? We learn when he was in Jerusalem, he was nearly beaten to death. He was almost tortured. He was arrested on bogus charges. He was punched in the face. And now there was a plot to kill him. You know, we learn in verses 12 to 13 that there was a conspiracy. At least 40 unbelieving Jews conspired, and they vowed that they wouldn't eat or drink until they had killed Paul. So there are several things that we can learn from here. I think the first thing that we can learn, or we can see that's very evident, is their hatred of Paul. They were taking an oath not to eat or drink until they killed him. Not to eat or drink until he died, but not to eat, not to drink until they killed him, right? And, you know, to be fair, if we were to look in the most charitable way, you know, to them, they really believed that Paul had committed horrible sins against God. It was their deep conviction, right? They said that Paul was against the temple, Paul was against the law, Paul was against the Jews. So in their minds, they truly believed that he was against God. And so nothing would be short. Nothing short of killing Paul in their minds would give glory to God. So there was this immense hatred. But the second thing that we see is their zeal to do this. Now, they took an oath. The Bible here in our version tells us it was a curse. And that's a very accurate translation. Now, in the Old Testament, there were many different ways of taking an oath. But the most severe way was the curse. And it was a vow, an oath to completely destroy and annihilate. You know, when God made this oath and he told the Israelites, go and utterly destroy the Canaanites, this was a curse. Right? Some of you know Arabic, right? You know the word halal, don't you? Right? Well, the opposite to that is haram. Haram means dirty. It is cursed. Right? Now, the Hebrew equivalent is the word cherem, which is curse. So something is dedicated to God, you're not to touch it. That's why to the Muslims, you know, pork and all of these things are accursed. They have been dedicated. You're not allowed to touch it. So this was their oath that Paul would be cherem. Paul would be dedicated to God. Paul would be sacrificed unto God. All right. And according to Leviticus, this kind of vow could not be broken. It had to be fulfilled. There had to be a death. And that is why we see their zeal. They would not eat. They would not drink. They would not even drink water. It shows the kind of... Now, medical people, you know, how long does it take before a person dies from thirst? All right, so they had a time limit, in other words. They would not eat, they would not drink until they succeeded in killing him. And if they couldn't kill him, they were willing to be cursed. In other words, he dies or we die. That was their zeal. Now, thirdly, we learn here that despite their vow to God, and they made it in the name of God, they were dishonest. Verse 14, we see here that they went to the chief priests and the elders to tell them of their plan. You see, what they needed, if they make this vow, they still needed the approval of the Sanhedrin. No man could go and kill another, you know, in such a way without the approval of the highest council in Israel. So they needed this approval. But notice here, who did they go before? the chief priests and the elders. They did not go before the entire Sanhedrin. They went before only the Sadducees, the chief priests and the nobility. Now, why do you suppose they didn't go before the entire Sanhedrin? Because previously, we saw it was the Pharisees who supported Paul. They said, we find nothing wrong with this man. So here, they convince the chief priests and the elders, and then they drew these Sadducees into their dishonesty. Look at verse 15. Now therefore, ye with the council, signify to the chief captain that ye bring him down unto you tomorrow, as though ye would inquire something more perfectly concerning him. And we, or ever he come near, are ready to kill him. You see, so they told the Sadducees, now please convince the council. So we know here they were not speaking to the entire council. They were only speaking to the Sadducees. But you Sadducees, convince the entire council, you know, and then convince the chief captain. You see, the Sadducees here could have denounced it, but they didn't. Instead, they approved it. And so they were drawn into this crime. And the plan was to hoodwink the Pharisees, the rest of the council, in order to ask Claudius to bring Paul. Bring Paul again. We want to investigate if what he says is really true. We want to investigate fully. But we see here there's an important phrase. We see here the phrase, as though. Look at verse 15. So, with the council, convince the chief captain, bring him down tomorrow, as though you would investigate. So this was a pretext. You know, say, oh, we didn't get to examine him fully the last time. You know, we were really fighting, remember that? So, you know, bring him so that we can talk to him again. But the real plan here was actually when he came near that they would kill him. So that was their zeal. That was their dishonesty. But we see further their ambition, right? They wanted to kill him along the way. Now, do you think that the chief captain would say, okay, Paul, you're released from prison. Go to the Sanhedrin now. Go. Go. Shoo. You're on your own. You can stop by the bakery along the way. Maybe visit your relatives. What do you think would happen? He would be accompanied. After all, he was a prisoner. And they had already seen the mobs that were trying to kill him, the Sanhedrin, which was trying to pull him apart. So they would send guards. And furthermore, it was because he was a Roman citizen. He would not be unescorted. So this would mean that these 40 unbelieving Jews were willing to ambush Paul along with the military escort that he had. And they knew that if there was such an uprising, Rome would respond with great anger. So they were prepared to create even political havoc. All right? They're taking on more than just Paul. They're taking on Rome. But more than taking on Rome, who do you think they were taking on? God himself. Because God, Christ, had already told Paul, you're going to testify of me in Rome. So this means that Paul had to survive. By doing this, by trying to kill Paul, they were trying to thwart the purposes of Christ. So unbeknownst to them, they were taking God on. They, you know, this threat of conspiracy was taken in the name of God, but they were against God. So secondly, the second point is, God was going to help. We see the provision of help by a sovereign God. Now, in all these things, does God help? Yes, if he so wills. You know, Christ already told Paul he would testify in Rome, so Paul would have to get out of this predicament. And what we see here is amazing. The way God has worked. God helped Paul sovereignly. And the first thing that he did was he used small people. And literally, I think, right? You know, sometimes God uses small things to help us. Now, we learn in verse 16 that Paul's sister's son, in other words, his nephew, he heard of this plot. He came to tell Paul. Now, we don't know much about Paul's family. We know here, at least, that he had a sister and a nephew. And because Paul grew up in Jerusalem, very likely his sister also grew up in Jerusalem. Now, we don't know how old this boy was. The Bible tells us that he was a young man. Now, a young man could be anywhere from little boy until 40 years old. Okay, so we really don't know how old this boy was, but it becomes clear in verse 19. Take a look at verse 19. We see here that Claudius took him aside by the hand, privately. You kind of have this mental picture, right? If this is a right interpretation, that he took the boy by the hand, so it was not a large boy, not a big boy, not a young man, took him to a corner, knelt down, right, spoke face to face with him in private, right? It shows a tenderness that might be required for someone so young, right? So it was not a powerful person, but it was a child. God's help would come through a child. And what's amazing is, if you think about it, all of these men, these 40 plus men, plus the Sadducees were working hard to get rid of Paul, but it was a child that messed up his plans, or their plans. You know, we look throughout the Bible, we're reminded of many things, like, you know, Moses, when he was put on the basket of reeds and floated to Pharaoh's daughter, who was there hiding the bulrushes, making sure everything was happening, and then told the Pharaoh's daughter where to find a wet nurse. It was Miriam, a small little girl, who was doing this. You know, when Jesus wanted to feed the 5,000, who did he use? A little boy with 5 loaves, right, and 2 fishes. Right? So what an amazing thing. So God can work through small people, small circumstances. And secondly, we see here that God worked through connections, you know, obscure connections, you might say. You know, God ruled, he overruled. And, you know, God did not only do it through this child, but he did it through the child's connection. I mean, what? How in the world did this child know about the plot? You know, did the child have a recording device? What's the Sanhedrin saying today? You know, or, you know, was he so obscure that he climbed the wall and, you know, heard? I mean, at the right time, at the right moment, you know, we don't know much about this nephew, but we do know that he had insider information. It may have come from friends and relatives who were in the council. I mean, Paul was in the council before. He was part of the Sanhedrin. So maybe there were remaining friends in there, you know, who said, you know, to Paul's sister, who then told the nephew. Maybe there were still friends. We don't know. Or maybe these 40 men who took a vow, where would they have had to go to make this vow? They would have had to go to the temple. So as secret as they wanted it to be, the news leaked out, as it usually does. You know, someone told someone who told someone. And finally, it came to the ears of Paul. And we see thirdly here, God's providence. How does it work? God worked through Paul's enemies. You know, when the nephew came to Paul to gain access, the centurion allowed access to Paul. And when Paul found out, who did he call? The centurion. Hey, take this boy to Claudius. There's this news. Can you imagine that? Here was a prisoner telling a prison guard, run this errand for me. Take this little boy. Bring him to Claudius. Right? Now, make no mistake. This centurion was not a friend. This centurion was an enemy. Right? you know, because it would be the Romans who would eventually kill Paul. And what is more, when this little boy was taken to Claudius, what did Claudius do? Take him by the hand, drag him to the side, and ask him, "Now you tell me what's happening. Are little boys usually known to be reliable witnesses?" Not always, right? Not always. But here we see that he listened. And after hearing him, he said, "Shh, keep this between you and me." So he trusted him. And here Claudius would take steps to try and protect Paul. But as we said, the Romans weren't Paul's friends. They would try him, they would judge him, they would execute him subsequently. Just remember that a couple of days before they were going to torture him to get the truth, remember, before he said he was a Roman citizen. But we see here that God has been using them to preserve him. They arrested him at the temple to save him from the mob. They brought him again out of the Sanhedrin to protect him from, you know, these warring forces, the fighting council members. And here we see they were about to save him again. You know, the news here must have been pretty sad for Paul. You know, imagine hearing the Jews, your own countrymen, you know, maybe your once friends, wanting to kill you. You know, and as you long for their conversion, even willing that you could be cursed so that they could be saved, he now learns here that they would stop at nothing to curse him. And furthermore, where was the church? You know, James and all of the other apostles and elders said to Paul, "Ah, Paul, welcome back. Now you go to the temple and you prove that you are not against the law." And then when he went to the temple and after that he was arrested, where were they? And furthermore, where were his traveling companions? Now, of course, there's silence, you know, which may not mean anything, but the silence here could mean everything. But whatever it is, we see that in God's sovereign providence, God would help in the most unusual of means, from this child who happened to hear, from his enemies. So God was still working in providence, right? And that's something that we need to remember. So despite this conspiracy, God was helping to unravel it. It's because God had a plan, and nothing can stop God from accomplishing, you know, what he sets out to do. I think that's an important thing, folks. God has a plan. He will bring it to pass. We are involved. And how it turns out may not be how we want it to turn out, you know, how we expect it to turn out, but it requires surrender and faith on our part. So thirdly, we see here the triumph of God's providence. The triumph of God's providence. Now, the first thing that we see here is how obviously it was displayed. You know, like I said before, you drive to a crowded car park, you need to attend a meeting, and suddenly a car comes out and someone gives you, you know, a parking ticket with two more hours on it. You're like, "Wow, this is amazing." And that's exactly what you see here. It was so obviously displayed. So after hearing from the boy, Claudius immediately took action. Verse 23 says, "And he called unto him two centurions, saying, Make ready 200 soldiers to go to Caesarea, and horsemen 70, and spearmen 200 at the third hour of the night." So we see here, you know, we know already that 40 unbelieving Jews were going to ambush Paul the next day. But the evening before, when Claudius heard this, he gave instructions for, now how many soldiers were there? 200 soldiers. How many cavalrymen? 70. How many spearmen or pikemen were there? 200. All right? This was an overkill. Don't you agree? Right? So, 400 fighting soldiers, 200 of them who were armed with spears. So, not just the Roman broadsword, all right, who were already a great fighting force, but he had pikemen with long spears to keep at bay those people who would come. And usually these pikemen would have these shields, full-length body shields with holes in the middle so that they could put their spears through, and so they could form different formations, a phalanx, you know, flanking, front and center, and so forth, just to keep at bay these 40 religious nut jobs. Right? Well, we don't know that they have military training, but there were 40 of them. And, you know, if you look at it, this, you don't really need many trained soldiers, but this was an overkill, right? Now, likely, some commentators say Paul, who was given a horse, would have been in the middle. Then he would have been surrounded by these 70 horsemen and marching at the side and the front in phalanx style would have been the 200 soldiers with broadswords. And then surrounding those would have been the pikemen, the spearmen, right? I don't think anyone has this kind of entourage today. Not the Pope, not the President, not the Prime Minister, right? Paul had his own special Air Force One, you know, to take him places, right? And we learned that they were traveling at 9 o'clock in the evening, the third hour of the night. And they traveled all night to get to Antipatris. All right, we see this in verse 31. That was about 60 kilometers away. All right, and so when the threat was kind of over, the horsemen would now leave him, and the rest of the 400 soldiers would still accompany him to Caesarea, which was another 40 kilometers away. So this was overkill. It was an obvious display of God's providence, right? His triumphant providence. Now, secondly, we see here how God helped in Paul's situation. We see that God marvelously acquitted Paul with facts. Now, in sending Paul to Caesarea, Claudius wrote Felix a letter. Now, who was this Felix? The Bible tells us that he was governor. His full name was Marcus Antonius Felix, and he was the head guy in Judea, just as Pontius Pilate was the head guy in Judea many years ago. All right, so Felix was now the head guy. And Claudius in this letter explained the circumstances, right? Who Paul was, why he was sending Paul to him. And we see here in verse 27 to 30 that Claudius wrote Paul was rescued from the Jews who wanted to kill him. He wrote that he brought Paul before the Sanhedrin to find out the charges. And we learn marvelously, verse 29, whom I perceived to be accused of questions of their law, but to have nothing laid to his charge worthy of death or of bonds. Now, what does this mean? So Claudius, being the chief captain, evaluated the situation. And according to Roman law, Paul could not be charged with anything. This was a question of Jewish religious law, and therefore Paul could not be rightly charged with death or imprisonment. All right, so why then was Paul being accompanied by Roman soldiers? Why was he being sent to Caesarea? Look at verse 30. It was because of the Jews. They wanted to kill him. So Claudius, in writing this letter, was saying, I'm sending you this guy. Hey, by all accounts, he's innocent. I can't find anything wrong with him. But you know who are the ones who are the really bad ones? It's the Jews, right? So Paul is acquitted by the recounting of facts. Now, of course, Claudius is a sinner, of course. He did some embellishments, if you read this passage here. In verse 27, he actually has the gall to give himself credit for rescuing Paul. The Jews would have killed him if I hadn't rescued him with an army. And you know why I did that? Because I found out that he was a Roman citizen. Now, that's kind of backwards, right? That's not how it happened. You remember? He was rescued by Claudius, but Claudius was about to torture him to get the truth. And only when he was about to be tortured, Paul said, I'm a Roman citizen. So Claudius kind of has his timeline a bit backwards, but nevertheless, what he had said earlier, these were all the facts. Now, thirdly, we see here that according to God's providence, that these accusers were cornered. All right? It's interesting, isn't it? The high priest and the elders, they were the ones who wanted to ambush Paul. They were the ones who wanted to corner him. You know, the mob couldn't get him. The Sanhedrin couldn't get him. And here, you know, Ananias, Baba, and his 40 thieves, they couldn't ambush him either. Right? But what is more is that now they were cornered. Claudius said in verse 30, let's take a look at verse 30. I gave commandment to his accusers also to say before thee what they had against him. So interestingly, it was no longer Paul who had to appear before the Sanhedrin, but it was now the Sanhedrin that had to appear before Felix. They were no longer the judges, but now they had to submit themselves to the Roman process. And we learn here that there would be due process. In verse 35, when Paul came before Felix, Felix said to him, he examined him, who are you? Okay, well, I will find out more when your accusers come. So not only would there be this due process that would go on, but what we learn that's amazing is that Paul could now preach the gospel again, and now he had an audience with Felix, the highest person in the land, and Paul had access to preach the gospel to such a pagan. So folks, from here, we all see God's providence at work, governing, providing safety to Paul, all because it was Christ's will for Paul to testify in Rome. But make no mistake here. Paul was still going to suffer. Paul suffered because of the wickedness of others, just as Jesus suffered because of the wickedness of others. And here we know that it was not over for Paul. You know, when Claudius dismissed the religious charges, and he said for the high priest to come before Felix, the high priest now knew, if I want to make any charge, I have to come with a political charge. And that's exactly what would happen. So now there was opportunity for the Jews to make a political charge. All right? And we learn that Paul, because of this, eventually he would spend 2 years in Caesarea. He would spend another 2 years in Rome. He would spend 1 year traveling there. And all of this was in God's providence. How can we doubt that it was not controlled by God? In like sense, in like way, providence is also in our lives. Not a single hair can drop from our head. Not a single hair can remain on our head without the permission of God. You know, good things happen in God's providence, but also the really dark things in our lives. And, you know, Paul was about to go through some very dark things, as some of us have gone through really dark patches in our life. But even in such situations, is God in control? Does He know what is happening? You know, God sometimes lets us suffer according to His will. And this thought may especially be very painful for those of us who have suffered greatly. But when we look at this and we look at our lives, what have we suffered in comparison to Christ? Have you ever suffered comparably to what Christ has suffered through? None of us. You know, and we know that Christ suffered because of no wrongdoing. But why do we suffer? Oftentimes, it's because of our own sins that we suffer. You know, folks, the world is a broken, broken place. Man sins. Man suffers. But Jesus has come to save man from his sins. And He tells us that one day we shall be with Him in paradise, where there is no more sin, where there is no more suffering, where there are no more tears. You know, through this we remember, as Paul was reminded, that these times of suffering would be for the purpose of witness. You know, it was for Paul, and it was especially for Christ who uttered. Remember, Christ said, "The hour is coming," when He prayed to God, "Glorify Thy Son, that Thy Son may glorify Thee." So when Jesus was being lifted up and glorified onto the cross, He said, "May that bring glory to God." And likewise, it was for Paul, as he suffered and as he was brought to Rome, "May that suffering bring glory to God." And likewise, for us, as we go through suffering, do we glorify God through it? You know, when Jesus was lifted up on the cross and all the people saw Him there, what was the word uttered, the words uttered by that centurion? "Truly, this was the Son of God." Through that suffering, "Truly, this was the Son of God." And likewise, when we suffer in accordance to God's providence, we serve as witnesses. And when we suffer, when we go through it surrendered, we rely on God that He would bring forth the sweet fruit of endurance, that as we go through it, He might bring forth that sweet fruit of purity as well. You know, God brings suffering to us that we may be changed. And that's that wonderful path of suffering. I guess the only thing that we have to ask is, will we walk in it? Or do we wait for every opportunity to escape it? So may the Lord grant us an understanding of His gracious providence in our lives, that as we go through whatever suffering that we have, we may glorify God and we may enjoy God through that process. Let us pray.